This is week three of interpreting the scriptures. Again, the goal of this is to give you some practical tools that you can actually go back and approach the way that you read the Bible and the way you teach the Bible. That's the big thing. The way that you teach the Bible in a way that is that can be replicated effectively. That you can encourage, bring life and practical next steps to people who are stepping into to Christianity through a brand new context, and that they're staring at the Bible like it's a calf at a new gate. They don't even know where to go, right? And so what we're going to do for this week is to focus on the Old Testament and how you can understand it yourself when you approach it with the right expectations. And then for next week, we'll look at the New Testament. We're not going to look at the prophets for today, but there's a lot to go through with the Old Testament. We'll look at the prophets at a different time. So that's the goal. Again, to give you confidence and to give you some practical tools that will help you understand and teach the scriptures in a way that is healthy. Lord, bless this time. Thank you for it. Thank you for these students. Thank you for your word, that it's alive, it's active. God, we step into this moment knowing that you're going to open up our eyes, cause our hearts to burn, so that we can follow you with our whole heart. God, allow this to not just be something that cognitively we get stretched and we get challenged, but it moves into the awakening of our soul, of our heart, and the way that we see you and see our world. We love you. Amen. All right. Again, the next two lessons, we'll briefly examine some of the major different types of literature in the Bible. Again, this is not going to be a snore fest. I guarantee it. I think we're going to enjoy it. There's going to be some things that I'm going to say that are not on your notes. And again, I'll go slow if you want to take notes. A narrative, again, the first is going to be a narrative. Again, a narrative is a story. It's a story. About 40% of the Old Testament is narrative. It's the most common genre in the Bible. We find it, again, you look at the first, you look at the first maybe 5, 6, 7 books of the Bible, and it's all narrative. From Genesis to Ruth, I mean, it's all stories. Stories. And we find that that God is speaking in these stories, but the way that we approach the stories is very, very important. Again, narratives are stories with a single plot and single set of characters. That's not in your notes, but that's what in each of the stories you have to look at who is the character? What are they trying to accomplish? Where is God in the story as well? The purpose is to show God at work within His creation. And then there's levels of narratives. I'm not going to go into too much depth here, but the top level is redemptive history. It's God's acts from the garden to the cross. It's looking at a narrative and seeing how does that play in the big picture of what's going to happen when it comes to Jesus. So like you go to the story of Joseph, right? And that's a great narrative that is top level. Points you to redemptive history, right? Even the book of Ruth. Great example of how God is using a book that isn't just random. It's everything about that story is going to point you ultimately to how Ruth becomes in the line of David, and then the story gets better from there. Right? So it's as you consider certain narratives. Again, I'm not one of those. I think that Jesus can be found throughout the whole Bible, but it gets a little tricky when you try to force Jesus at every point, right? But there are moments, there are narratives that it's impossible to see. Like you have to see Jesus, right? And when it comes to Abraham, when it comes to as he takes his son Isaac to a mountain, the location of that mountain, and again, the sacrifice of that son, everything about that is a redemptive historical narrative. It's pointing you to the cross. Does that make sense? So that's top level. And then you have like middle level, which is, it centers on people, Israel. It's the call of Abraham, Abrahamic covenant, enslaving of Israel, redemption, etc. The bottom level is, and when I say top, middle, it doesn't mean like the bottom level is like the worst. Just when you look though, it's individual narratives that make up the other two levels. So it's a focus just on the characters. The narratives do not provide us with full biographies of individuals. They usually serve to reveal something about God and or His redemptive purposes. The characters are not always presented as role models. It's really important to know that. The narratives show us that the consequences of choices, sometimes good, sometimes bad. So, and with a lot of the narratives, they just end. Like, they just drop off, right? And so it's important that, and we'll talk about this, it's important that we don't fill in the gaps where the text does not. Does that make sense? But when it comes to the whole idea of role models, though, you look at Samson, the ideal. I mean, like, when we look at him, he's not a role model. He's not something that we want to point to our kids and say, "Hey, be just like this dude." But the whole purpose of examples such as Samson is for us to see the power of consequences, the importance of obedience. The historical context in that story is extremely important. But again, it's just making sure that we have appropriate expectations as we go to the narratives. What narratives are not? These are not in your notes, but these are just a few thoughts. They're not stories about people in Old Testament times. It's not just stories. It's that God is the hero, ultimate protagonist, or leading decisive character in all the narratives. So it's easy to look at these narratives, and if you're not careful, you just look at them as a history book, right? But again, the goal of every one of the narratives is to point us to the ultimate hero. Exactly. Again, they're not allegories filled with hidden meanings. It's easy to take certain stories and then to insert, like, just to get really creative with, like, for example, the story of Joseph. Pharaoh is this. Jacob is this. And where we come up with all types of meanings and ultimate conclusions about every part of the story to make it preach better or pop off the page better. Again, it's important, though, that you allow the text to speak for itself. And that it interprets itself. Remember, that's the whole idea of that stool of hermeneutics. Its historical background is one leg. Its interpretation through observations. And often, the Bible, you allow the Bible to interpret itself. Right? So you don't have to. And the last leg is the importance of application. So it's not depersonalized from you. It always has to come back with, how is God speaking to me personally? So it's not an allegory. Again, each individual narrative doesn't necessarily have a moral of its own. Again, it's just making sure we have right expectations as we consider these narratives. Narratives are not full of mysterious hidden meanings. Some things are not clear. We're not always told what, how, or why God did or did not do something. Narratives should always be read and interpreted in light of their historical, cultural context. Again, I keep saying this, but it's important for us to make sure that we take the text and allow it to have a reverberation in our heart that is robust through the historical context that allows it to be robust. Does that make sense? So knowing what's happening in behind the scenes. Like a great example, I've been studying. I'm in a class on Joshua Judges. About to graduate in May. This is one of my final classes, and I thought I'd just go for the gusto, right? So I went with Joshua and Judges, and this is a book that a lot of people focus on, just the conquest, right? It's all about and people read this book and they question God in it. God is basically doing like a Rwanda moment years ago. Like ethnic cleansing. That's how it's read. That's how a lot of people interpret it. And so what you have to do in the book of Joshua, what I'm finding, is that you have to consider that Joshua is just a mirror of Moses. Everything that Moses did, you find in the book of Joshua, Joshua doing the same thing. So it's almost like the Pentateuch, which is the first five books, Joshua continues the Pentateuch. A lot of people call that like the Hexateuch. And so what you find in Joshua is that what started in Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 19 of the covenant, that Joshua's continuing that. And the covenant is about people, God's people, and God's place of Canaan. So everything about Joshua is about this place. It's the restoring of Eden. What Canaan was, it was where Eden was. So everything about the people of Israel coming into the promised land, it had a very set parameter that the way that God saw that place was holy, right? That's why he calls the place that you're standing is holy ground. And in Joshua 12, where you have this captain of the Lord's host, he's holding a sword. And what that's supposed to do is point you back to the sword of the angel in Eden that was guarding and protecting like the holy ground, like the holy land. And so like no one could go back in because this man with a sword is standing there, right? Well, now in Joshua chapter 12, we have this captain of the Lord's host that comes to Joshua, and Joshua says, whose team are you on? You on our team? You on their team? What's going on? And he says, neither. Now, I'm the captain of the Lord's host. The place that you're standing is holy ground. And what we're finding, what you see in Joshua is that everything about this place of holy ground, of God's promised covenant with a people and with a place, and then even the hesitation and the desire for peace in Joshua. It's not about just killing people for killing's sake. It's about how God's promised land requires a certain type of response, a disposition, and a holiness. And so what God is doing is cleansing everything in that land that is going to poison his people. Right? So it's not about Rwanda. It's not about ethnic cleansing. It's not about these horrific experiences that we see. And what he does in Joshua, he never does again. Or he doesn't do it at the level that he does in the book of Joshua. So again, like seeing historical context, I know that was a tangent. I have to have places to like release what I'm learning. And this happens to be one of them. So, sorry. So, but it's like when it comes to understanding even things like Joshua, you can read it through a certain perspective, but if you don't have the historical context and even biblical context, it's easy to assume certain things that it's never meant to communicate. And I think there's multiple examples, but that for me is a glaring one. Narratives illustrate truths and principles taught directly elsewhere, especially in the Mosaic Law. Narratives should be read in the context of the larger purpose of the book they are found in. And so, like when in Deuteronomy and all throughout the Mosaic Law, you find all of these interesting, unique demands, right? So, and we'll look at a few of them, but it's important to understand that God was setting up certain rules through the Mosaic Law to protect his people, to keep them clean, to enable them to have longevity in their life, and doing certain things was going to ensure that. So to now look at the book of Deuteronomy and to pull out certain things to say, now I've got to do this because they did it. Hold on. Therein lies the importance of seeing that Jesus came to fulfill the law, right? That everything about who Jesus is, and that's why Jesus is constantly, he's quoting one book, or not one, but he's putting a lot of focus on the book of Deuteronomy. Why? Because he is the completion of all of the covenants that have come before him. He is the covenant. That's why the Passover, that's why he solidified him being the fulfillment of that covenant at the Lord's Supper. Number two, dialogue is an important feature of Old Testament narratives. Dialogue. Old Testament narratives often have more dialogue than action. People are portrayed by dialogue, not by the description of the narrator. Therefore, dialogue provides insight into their character. This is really important. It's not just about, the whole goal is not just about to know about someone, but to actually know them, right? Where you actually get a, you get to step into their world. That's why the story of Joseph is so much, is so engaging, because you hear, you see him crying. You see him yelling. You see him struggling through the place, the conflict that he's facing. The naming of his sons that is coming out of his own pain. The discussion with his brothers. Like, that's a great example of an amazing narrative that allows us as human beings to step into the story. For example, Joseph's statement to his brothers in Genesis 50:20, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it this for my good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives," reflects his deep trust in the providence of God. So again, theology is brought out of certain narratives because it points us back to the character and nature of God. Again, that's why it's so important to put into proper context that the hero of the story is not the person. It's the God of the story, right? It's the God who is working in and through all of these activities for his perfect purpose. Again, going back to providence, it's God's hand working to orchestrate an end that, in spite of the weakness and in spite of all of the depravity of the human heart, that God is working, he's cinching it tight, making him God, making him now someone that we can trust in the good times as well as in the bad. Principles of interpreting Old Testament narratives, I'll fly through this. These are just a few thoughts. Does not teach doctrine. Does not teach doctrine. It represents a doctrine taught in its fullness other places in the Scripture. Does that make sense? So you can't find you go back to the story of the story of Joseph to teach the doctrine of the providence of God. That in and of itself doesn't teach you the providence of God. It becomes an example that proves this. You can't just rest in it alone to understand a doctrine. Does that make sense? Are there any thoughts, any questions? I don't want to get too deep here. Are there thoughts? So far, so good? Okay. If you get confused, just throw up your pen at me. It represents a doctrine taught fullness in its fullness at a different place. It records what happened, not what should have happened. It's very important. It records what happened, not what should have happened. People's actions in narratives are not necessarily a good example for us. It's not always told. Old Testament narratives are filled with raw people. I can think that's the whole purpose. Is it's about allowing us to see people even at their worst, and then God's commitment to use them in spite of themselves. And again, I've talked about this, but just the errors of interpreting these books is you allegorize. Again, I've talked about that. And you overly personalize, right? It's easy to take certain examples and then I think for us to take the example of Joseph and say that this is an example that ultimately leads to Christ. That's the purpose. But when we say that we are Josephs, that may be a little bit too personal. Does that make sense? Again, it's making sure that we hold in tension the purpose of the story and what it's pointing us to. Again, narratives demonstrate God's involvement in the world and illustrate his principles and calling. Again, it's all about God's commitment to using humanity, even when everyone else thinks that God can't use it. Again, God never wastes a pain. That's the whole purpose. All throughout the Old Testament, you're seeing pain after pain after pain that is the result of this, the human condition and the fallen world. And yet God's constant commitment to using His humanity for His purposes when you don't see it coming. Number two, the Mosaic Law. The Mosaic Law. The Mosaic Law makes up a substantial portion of the Bible and provides the foundation for the entire Old Testament. When we say Mosaic Law, it's the Torah. And that's the law portions of the Pentateuch. It's the law portions. So you find law portions in Deuteronomy, you find them Leviticus. There's multiple sections all throughout the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch, when I say that, it's the first five books of the Bible, right? And then if you include Joshua, that makes it a Hexateuch. Now, that I just like saying that word. It's just fun. Why is the Torah so why is it so important? And why did God actually give that to us? Again, it focuses on God and His deliverance of Israel from slavery out of the most powerful empire in the entire world. His presence that returned to Israel and distinguished it from all the other nations. So in the book of Exodus, you find example after example after example of God's choosing of this people. Now, it started in Genesis chapter 12, again, in the first five books, you have Genesis, right? And he goes, he approaches Abram, who was a foreigner. It's important to know that. He was a foreigner who worshipped foreign gods. He was 70 years of age in almost a retirement community. Like he had moved to the coast, and he had everything you could possibly imagine. And in the most inconvenient of times, God comes to Abram and says, he basically says, I have chosen you. I want to bless you, and I'm going to make you a blessing. And what we find in Genesis 12 is that he's starting over just like he did in Genesis chapter 6 with Noah. You have Adam and Eve. They go off the rails. And then in the first 12 books of the Bible, you see God just constantly trying to go back to restoring what was lost in Genesis chapter 3. So he does it with Noah. That goes terribly wrong. And then he tries it again for the last time with Abram. And from that point forward, he now chooses, he gives his presence and sets apart a people that would be his own. And what this would do is that this would now set a trajectory of the people of Israel, his chosen people, that God now commits himself fully to. And he proves it with this covenantal moment, right? Where he puts Abram in a trance. He's asleep and he sees this, all of these animals cut in two, right? And blood just everywhere. And then what would happen is that you would have the vassal, the one who's in control of the covenant, the ones that's the higher power, who would sit to the side, and then the one who was the weaker vessel would walk through and say, "Be it done to me if I don't complete this covenant." But what we find in this example with Abram is that Abram is always on the side, and God himself walks through the covenant and says, "Be it done to me if you don't complete this." So at that point, from that point forward, he's pointing us to what's going to happen to Jesus. So Jesus would go to the cross to now redeem and restore everything lost in Genesis chapter 3. It's a singular story all throughout the Old Testament, and it's exemplified and it's unpacked in these first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. God's, again, why is this so important? It's God's presence. It's God's deliverance. God reconstituted Israel as His special people at the foot of Mount Sinai. So in Exodus chapter 19, we find after 300 years of imprisonment, the people of Israel were a distinct people before God. In this difficult task, an enormous task that the people were unprepared for, the Torah was given to guide them in that task. So the whole point of the Torah, these laws, right? The whole point of the laws was to help the people of Israel be the people of Israel through the journey that they were facing. So everything about it was not just do this, do this, do this, like we were made for the law. No, the law was made for us to keep us in right relationship with God. Does that make sense? So everything about the Torah was speaking to a specific people at a specific time to help them relate to God effectively, to keep them in right contact with their Creator. That was the whole point. Now, we don't, like, when we think of the laws, that's not necessarily what we think of. But, like, that's why this class is so vital, to help you understand that when you look at the Torah, when you look at the first five books of the Bible and the laws, make sure you understand, and as you teach them, like, this is, God's grace was in the law. God loved His people so much, He gave them rules and laws to keep them safe, to protect them, and to keep them, to make them the best of what they could be, and both personally, in their community, relationally, and in their relationship with God. So again, God's grace was found in the Torah, in these laws. Yet it records many laws that seem strange to us in the 21st century. For example, do not cook a young goat in its mother's milk. Exodus 34:26. That's different. Do not wear clothing woven of two kinds of materials. Leviticus 19:19. Make tassels on the four corners of the cloak you wear. Deuteronomy 22:12. Again, these are, you look at them and you're like, man, how does this work? Am I supposed to walk around with tassels? Thank you for the reminder that I'm not supposed to cook a goat in its mother's milk. But understanding the intention behind the God of the Torah, of the law, that He is all of the laws that He gives, and He gives over 800, that all of these laws, all of these laws ultimately are helping encourage and protect and keep in line His people in order to live successfully in the culture that they find themselves in. How should we understand the Mosaic Law in relation to the New Covenant, and how should we apply it to our lives in this day and age? The following is a method developed by J. Daniel Hayes for understanding and applying the Mosaic Law. Step 1. Identify what particular law meant to the original audience. Again, historical context. Look for the historical and literary context of the specific law by asking the following questions. Was the law given in response to a specific situation? What other laws are in the immediate context, and is there a connection between them? Did the law govern how people were to relate to God or to others? Did the law relate to agriculture, commerce, civil affairs, or life in the Promised Land? Step 2. Determine the difference between original audience and believers today. For example, we do not approach God through the sacrificial system. We do not live under a theocracy. And we are not preparing to enter the Promised Land. Again, so what were all this? I know in a class like this, you read those steps and you're like, okay, those are great. I'm never going to do that. So what you have to come to grips with is that reading the Bible, it may require a different way of reading it, where you read it slowly. It's not about quantity necessarily. At times it is, but it's often not about quantity, it's about quality. So as you step into your readings, especially of the Mosaic Law, especially the first five books of the Bible, you can't just grab and go with this. You can't just go to a story because you want some personal encouragement, and so you find a story that you know is guaranteed to encourage you. Although at times that's very, like, I think there's grace for that. But in order to approach, to handle the Bible with kid gloves, with propriety, it's going to require some time and study. Thoughts? Any questions about this? It's a lot, and then It's hard to find next steps of how am I going to do this. And I think I would really encourage you to take a story that you can absolutely crush, like Joseph. Like a Joseph, like Abram. I mean, both of those stories, they are pretty extensive. Like Joseph starts in chapter 36, I think, Genesis, and goes to 50. So we're talking about a pretty large, I mean, if you just took the next year and just studied Joseph's life and what he must have gone through and what it would have been like to go from a complete focus or a complete mosaic family, right, that whose whole life was built on God's covenant. Now you're transported into Egypt, different culture, completely different customs. God is nowhere to be found. And yet you're all by yourself living on purpose for this God. Like this, I think we can do what I just said if we were to take a story like that and start there. Okay. Again, the sacrificial systems, all of like, when we talk about like, the book of Leviticus is all about access to God through sacrifices, right? And it wasn't because we have a bloodthirsty God. Okay? It wasn't because God is just he wants to punish. Blood represented life. And what's happening with sin isn't just an external, oh shucks, I missed it again. It's a constant reminder of what sin is. It's a heart problem. That's why all throughout the book of Leviticus, especially, you have this focus on leprosy. Leprosy was one of the greatest tools or illustrations that Jesus used to describe what sin was, right? That it went down deep. It couldn't be fixed. You were separated from the camp. You weren't allowed to come into the city. You were kept on the outskirts, in the desolate places. You were isolated. You were alone. You were not a part of the community of God. If you came into the camp, you would be killed. There was so much. Why? Because it was contagious. They didn't want anybody else to get this thing. And it attacked the central nervous system first, where you couldn't feel anything. And then all of a sudden your limbs start falling off, or you're burning yourself, and you don't even know that you're burning yourself. I mean, everything about leprosy pointed to sin. And so when it comes to the again, the grace of sacrificial system, it wasn't just rules. He wanted to stay in right relationship with humanity. That was his goal. And he used the sacrificial system to do that. To keep right relationship with humanity through the blood of goats and bulls. And that's why Hebrews talks so much about we don't have, like, Jesus is greater. He's better than everything on the outside when it comes to Moses and the law and priests and blood of goats and bulls. He's better than that. So, get all of the sacrificial systems, it points us ultimately to one person in Jesus Christ. The sacrificial system, it establishes personal communion with Yahweh. This is huge. That as you sacrifice, as you brought, you would bring a goat or a lamb. You would take this lamb and the priest would lay hands on it and the sins of your family would be put on that lamb and then the lamb would be killed. And in doing that, you're giving, again, it's the best lamb that you've got, and you're watching, it probably has a name, and it's dying. And you're seeing, and your heart sinks, and you realize how your sin brings death. But in that death comes a restoration of your relationship with God. So everything about the atonement, even the language of the atonement, Leviticus, you would have this moment once a year. You would bring two goats. One, you would lay your hands on it, and it would be released. It would be called the Azazel. It would be sent away. That's what that name kind of means. The other would be killed, and so which is very is amazing to me, that when the crowd is shouting for Jesus to be crucified, or they're basically saying, "Send him away, Azazel." So you have even in the last days of Jesus, a completion of what would happen in the times of Leviticus in this atonement moment of one being sacrificed, one being sent away. In Jesus, you have one being both sent away and sacrificed all at the same time. So all of this, I know it's a lot, but all of this has purpose though. Like God is using all of these experiences and expressions that are misunderstood often, but if you can understand them right, you'll see God through a new perspective. Again, the point of atonement is there's three ramifications. These are not in your notes, but the first is consecration. Your status is changed from unclean to holy. So you were, as a result of the atonement, of the sprinkling of blood for the sins of Israel, the result of that was consecration. It was also purification. It's changing, again, these are not in your notes, I apologize. So it's consecration, purification, the changing the condition, not just the status, but the condition of a person from unclean to clean. So your external was changed, your status, your internal was also changed, where now you had the power to live as clean. But because the human heart wasn't changed in those days, you would always go back because of the sin pattern. It's like it's what Proverbs calls like a dog returning to its vomit. I know it's disgusting, but a dog is sick because of something that they've taken in. They release it, and then they always find a way of going back to the thing that made them sick, and then they devour it. That's what's happening with this. All of these sacrificial systems are pointing to all of us that external sacrifices don't change an internal problem. That's why we need, why we ultimately need Jesus. That's why he becomes the primary blood and goat. Like the ultimate sacrifice that changes the condition as well as the status. Right? So that because of Jesus, now we have a right relationship with God externally, and then he's given us a new heart internally, and he's sealed it through his body and blood, and then he's given us an experience that reminds us through communion and through baptism. So if we try to like tie the Old Testament with the New Testament, like we do have sacrificial systems, but it's not what you're used to. It's communion and baptism. They're expressions, that experiences that we actually walk into that point us back to what we already have and remind us of our status externally and our condition internally. Even with baptism doesn't save you, right? But it's an outward expression of an internal transformation. All right. So consecration, purification, and forgiveness. Forgiveness. It's the removal of guilt and the obedience that results. So these are 30 minutes. Gotcha. Consecration, purification, and forgiveness. Consecration, purification, forgiveness. There's five types of sacrifices. Again, if you want to write these down, these again are not in your notes. I thought that they would be helpful for you as you're considering what's going on when it comes to sacrificial systems. Burned offering. There's the grain or cereal offering. The peace or fellowship offering as the sin or purification. And then guilt, reparation offering. I'll go through them again. Burnt offering, grain, peace, sin or purification. And then guilt or reparation offering. Those were the five types of offerings. Five types of sacrifices that the people of Israel were, that they commonly made. It was a part of the rhythms of their life that they participated in on a yearly basis. When it comes to what God is doing with these sacrifices, God's holiness would consume anything unworthy. Therefore, the person would put the animal or substitute for the guilty person. So what's happening is that as a result of sin comes like the judgment or the some call the anger, like God's anger. It's just his justice, right? It's that God is, he's completely loving and he's completely just all at the same time. And because of his justice, he has to extend. He has to extend that justice to anything that breaks his ultimate rule, or his right relationship through holiness. He can only relate to people who are like himself, right? So that's why we would walk in the garden in the cool of the day with Adam and Eve. They were in right relationship with them because they were untouched by sin. That it was a relationship made by fellowship and freedom and function. It was like they had an unending circle of love and trust because of the fact that sin had nothing to do with it. Sin comes into it, and instead of killing Adam and Eve instantly, beginning in Genesis chapter 3, an animal, what we find is that God put skins on them. Now, in order to have a skin, you have to have a sacrifice. Something has to die, right? And so in Genesis chapter 3, we have the first example of this sacrificial system being put into play. From that point forward, God, whenever sin comes in, God's holiness rejects that, but there has to be judgment for that. And that is the reason that you would take something like an animal, you would exchange it for yourself. Because if you didn't do that, it was you. You were the one. You were the guilty party. But now you're putting all of your sins on something else. Again, this beautiful foreshadowing of what Jesus would do. All right. Enough about the sacrificial systems. Let's keep going. Step 3. Develop universal principles from the text. Each Mosaic law had a meaning for its first audience, but that meaning was based on a broader universal truth applicable to all God's people, regardless of which covenant they live underneath. Step 4. Correlate the principle with New Testament teaching. So the principle with the teaching. Filter the universal principle through the New Testament, through that New Testament teaching regarding that principle. Like, for example, the universal principle of the prohibition against adultery, it's Exodus 20, verse 14, is the sanctity of marriage. In the New Testament, this principle is augmented through Jesus' teaching in Matthew 5, 28, when he says, "But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart." So you have this one teaching leads us to the next teaching, but the connection is Jesus. Because what Jesus is saying when he says, if you look at a woman with lust in your heart, or man, that pretty much includes all of us. So what Jesus is doing is he's like ratcheting up all the rules and saying, and he's basically saying, all of you. He's saying Paul's words long before Paul said them, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. That's the whole purpose of what Jesus does with the Sermon on the Mount. Is he takes the Old Testament and he brings application when it comes to the New Testament, but he makes it so impossible to fulfill that the only way to fulfill it is through Jesus. He puts himself as the hinge and saying, look, this door is going to shut on everybody who doesn't come through me. That's why he calls himself the door. Does that make sense? Step 5. Apply the modified universal principle to life today. Paul applied the universal principle in the Old Testament law. Do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain in Deuteronomy 25:4 to defend the right to receive material support from the Corinthians. That's in 1 Corinthians 9. A couple more things that I think is really important for us to know about the Old Testament law. I'm just going to say this part and then we'll move on. When we talk about Old Testament law, I've used this word covenant a lot. And what a covenant was is suzerain law. S-U-Z-E-R-A-I-N. Suzerain law. It had an overlord. And yes, it's suzerain. Suzerainty, like treaty. So it was a S-U-Z-E-R-A-I-N. Suzerain law. And this was a covenant that was common in that culture. It wasn't just for Israel. You find it in historical documents from that day all over. So suzerain law was just a way by which a covenant was formed that was lasting between an overlord and a one that was a vassal. So you have one who is in control of it, the one that's more powerful, and then you have a weaker, dependent vassal. So you have an overlord and a vassal. And then the covenant, the format had six parts to it. It had a preamble, a prologue, witnesses, sanctions or requirements, and then a document clause. So, and then what you find all throughout the book of Genesis is that it follows that. Now, all of those parts of a suzerain law were normalized in the culture of the state. It's just beautiful to see how God takes the culture and uses the culture for his purposes to communicate and to relate with his people. So he uses language that they would have known. Does that make sense? Okay. So that all throughout the Old Testament, though, when it comes to suzerainty law, that was an extremely important way of God as the overlord dealing with the weaker participants. All right, let's move on to the Psalms. Psalms. The benefit of the Psalms. I'm not sure if these are in your notes. They guide us to worship. Relating honestly to God, there's importance of reflection and real meditation. So it's importance of reflection, meditation. The Psalms are poems written to be sung in worship in their relationship to God. They appeal to our emotions as well as our intellect and help us express ourselves honestly to God, including our joys, sorrows, hopes, fears, and regrets. Again, so when we consider the Psalms, an important word there, it's poetry. So it's important to consider the Psalms in relationship to other texts, because between Psalms and Proverbs, if you draw conclusions or theology from those, then those, like when it comes to the one psalm by itself, you're isolating the text. You're not exegeting it, bringing it in line with the rest of the text that talk about that specific theme. So what is beautiful about the Psalms, though, is its honesty. It helps us see and relate to God in any place of life, right? When things are going really, really well, and when things are literally upside down. So it constantly brings the human story back into play, which I think is so vital. And I love how God sees our weaknesses. And he's always meeting us in those weaknesses, and he refuses to ignore them. Again, they appeal to our emotion. I love that. Understanding the Psalms means realizing that the Bible isn't just words from God to people, but a book spoken to God or about God. So it's us actually speaking back, right? He just doesn't speak to us, but like we come into line with people who are actually talking back. This helps us express ourselves to God and consider who He is. Right? So like this, actually, like when we don't have the words, when our heart is so broken, we don't know what to say to God, we can go to the Psalms, and the Psalms put words into our mouth that we desperately want to say. We just don't know how to. So again, this is like considering this and even using the Psalms to teach your kids about how to communicate with God in times of desperation and depravity. Helping our children understand, and our grandkids see the magnanimity, the extensiveness of this God who is working all things together for His good and for our good and His glory. Like that's what's so beautiful about the Psalms. Psalms, again, are poetry. They are addressed to the mind through the heart. They're addressed to the mind through the heart. So it's the emotion of the heart that helps to equip the mind. They're musical poems. Again, the vocabulary throughout the Psalms often is metaphorical. Like, a great example, you have given me the feet of a deer that I may climb upon the rocks or the heights. Well, what's he saying? That we're all deer? Like, fear the deer? I mean, what's he saying? The point of it is considering the way that the deer's feet are uniquely made, that enable them to go places that nobody else can go. That in God, He's formed us to go places, to take heights that everyone else can't go, and we can go because we've been made like that. That God's formed us to go places in our understanding of who God is, and even when things feel like they're against us, that God's going to make a way. So again, it's metaphorical language that helps us understand both God's purposes and His heart for us, His compassion. There are different types of psalms which functioned in different ways. Some examples are listed below. Lament psalms express struggle, suffering, or disappointment. It is, I love this, it is the largest group of psalms. isn't that good? There's more than 60 of them. Here's a few for you to go back and look if you want to. They're individual lament psalms, which are in Psalms 3 and 22, 39. And then their corporate lament psalms, which is 12, 44, 94, 137. If the greatest amount of psalms is lament, is struggle, it's pain, what we find the gospel in that. That understanding God means and rightly relating to Him and understanding His character and His nature helps us see that following God doesn't mean that things are perfect all the time. Which I know that's simplistic, but in our culture that has completely warped and poisoned an understanding like following God means that He's going to hook me up all the time. That now, because He's with me, like His job in my life is to make things perfect. Right? Now I think for some of us, we look at that and like, oh, that's terrible. Like who would think that? Let me just tell you, from a younger perspective, everyone sees God like that. They view God as a glorified therapist. That your job is to make me comfortable. To give me what I need, to help me through my problems. And so God becomes one of many parts of our life that he's supposed to like grease the wheels for everything else to go the way that we want it to. And that's not honoring, that's not a relationship with God, it's just as idolatry. Yeah. Right? There's nothing different from that perspective than in the times of Israel or even in Corinth, where deities were used, were manipulated to get what you wanted. So, I love the fact that there's over 60 lament psalms because it helps us realize a proper perspective of what it means to follow God. That there will be pain, but God is with us in the pain. Thanksgiving psalms express joy over good circumstances and God's blessing. There are individual Thanksgiving psalms in 18, 32, 40, 138, and corporate Thanksgiving psalms in 65, 75, 107, and 136, if you want to write those down. There's praise psalms. Honor God for His greatness and goodness. 8, 19, 33, 66, 100, etc. Salvation history psalms review God's great deeds done for Israel. You can find those in 78, 105, 106, 135, and 136. Celebration psalms affirm a divine covenant, a specific monarchy, the enthronement of the king or God's holy city. For example, again, let me just reiterate that. These are psalms that would be declared when a king was put into place. Okay? So it's Psalms 2 is one of them. And in that psalm, you have words like, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I'm well pleased." Can you think of another time where that psalm was used? Jesus and his baptism. By who? By God the Father. So when God is... Let me just slow this thing down a little bit. When God is saying in front of people, "This is my son, my love," that would be said to Davidic kings, and like that was a normal psalm proclaimed that when a king was being put into position, like that God is taking full commitment. He's committing himself to that king. That because the people were so important, that king was now his son. Right? And because as a result of that king being in place, even though God's original design was never for a king, he was supposed to be the king. But now, because the people wanted to be just like everybody else, 1 Samuel chapter 7, it just leads people of Israel into this place of chaos and confusion, right? And so, the result was they wanted to have this reign of kings, which is ultimately a reign of terror. Nobody was good enough. Everybody was jacked up. And then, when a king was put into place, they were told, Psalms 2, "This is my son." When Jesus was baptized, he comes up and God says, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I'm well pleased." He's declaring to the world, he's the Messiah, the ultimate king that you've been waiting for, that you've been designed for, that you've been longing for, that's better than every other king you could possibly imagine. And he says it again in Mark chapter 9. "This is my son whom I love. Listen to him." Mount of Transfiguration. So, the Psalms are beautiful because it points you to something that's going on in the greater narrative of the Bible. That is so, if you see certain things that pop off the page, they're popping off the page because they're probably tied and tethered to Jesus at some point. It is important to recognize the figurative language throughout many of the Psalms. The Psalms employ hyperbole, metaphor, personification. I mean, this is an English class right here. Simile. Like, it just takes classic poetry and it rolls it into what's happening with the Psalms. So, reading it in the same way that when you read poetry, you don't... It's not a historical document, necessarily. But it's a type of language, again, that informs the head through the emotion of the heart. That's the goal, that's the point, the purpose of the Psalms. I've got some notes on Psalms. I'm not sure. I think we've done a pretty good job talking about the purpose of the Psalms. Okay. The Proverbs. Again, the goal is responsible and successful living. I'm not sure if that's in your notes. But the point of the Proverbs, again, is not theology. But it's successful, it's responsible and successful living. And then when it comes to wisdom, the word wisdom is used on blast. Again, it's a book of wisdom. And when it comes to wisdom, it's one's orientation towards God. The way you see Him, the way that you operate, the way your disposition in relationship to Him. And what this book is going to do is it's going to inform us of what it looks like to operate with wisdom or to have a proper heart practically as you relate to God. It focuses on people and their behavior. The focus is not being wise, but getting wise through applying God's truth to the experiences that they have. So it's about a process, a journey of wisdom, where the challenges of life, God wants to meet us in those challenges so that we have right relationship and understanding of God that now is practically expressed through proper living. Central theme of all of the wisdom books is fearing God, with the flip side of the same coin, turning away from evil. So fear God, turn away from evil. It's always kind of connected. Now, the New Testament has a wisdom book, and it's the book of James. So a lot of the same principles that you read the book of Proverbs with, you can now turn to the book of James and consider James through that same approach, right? Because you find in James a lot of do, a lot of expression, a lot of outward focuses. But again, the focus of all wisdom literature is a right relationship with God through right living. Okay, living right, living well. So living right with God and well with the community right around you. Biblical wisdom equals living life in God's world by God's rule. When it comes to biblical wisdom, it's living life in God's world by God's rule. So it's the whole point of it is it's almost like it's a continuation of the mosaic of like the first five books of the Bible, where it's constantly helping us see how God has a way to live. And he's not imposing it, like forcing us, but he's trying to woo us in through right relationship. If you follow this, I'm telling you, you're going to be successful. I'm telling you, everything that you touch is going to, man, God's going to be with it if you just continue to take steps that I've invited you to take. Wisdom genres within the life and construct of Israel. Again, it's you know what? Don't I'm not even going to go there. We're short on time. So the Proverbs are mostly brief, memorable expressions of wisdom meant to help an ancient Israelite make wise, godly choices in life lived out under the Mosaic Law. So again, it's wisdom in context and in concert with the Mosaic Law. Proverbs are not legal guarantees from God. Very important. They are general principles that point to outcomes which are likely to occur when one chooses a wise, godly life. So it's not promises. Like you said in Proverbs 10:31, the Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but He thwarts the cravings of the wicked. And yet, you find in Paul, the Apostle Paul often went hungry. So again, it's you got to hold it tight, right? It's not just because it's promises that remind us of God's nature and character. We can't look at those Proverbs and guarantee, like, God, you have to do this. And we keep God and His nature in, it's almost as a prisoner to those promises. Does that make sense? It's making sure that we use them properly and they point us back to God's nature and His character. Again, these are the ones that are hard, I think, for us. Because we live in a world where we understand it's a plug and play type of operation with God. That it's about, again, often it can be the focus of our relationship with God is my comfort and my needs. And we use whatever the Bible has to offer to prove that. And And when it comes, again, the whole point of the scriptures is to see that God works in all types of settings and circumstances, and he's involved in all of it. Even when we don't like it, he's definitely involved in it, as hard as it may be. And as raw and as messy as the process is, we have constant promises that God is with us in the midst of it. I think those promises, though, is that the Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, is a great, that keeps our heart in right alignment with God's nature and character. But even when we are hungry, God, you're still with me. No single proverb or set of proverbs should alone be used to develop a doctrine, authoritative teaching. Instead, everything the Bible teaches on a given subject must be considered. The brevity of a proverb aids memorization, but prevents it from being an exhaustive statement. No individual proverb is a complete statement of truth. Each must be balanced with other proverbs and the rest of Scripture. All right. Are there any thoughts, any questions, any concerns? I know this is a lot. Probably way too much. But my hope is that you go back and you look. If there's a couple of areas that we studied today that are really attractive to you, I would go back and really dive in and take the notes and use it this week as a direct application, so that this stuff doesn't just become knowledge that is way too big for us, and we're like, it's like a suit that you buy that, you know, you want to get to a certain size and bulk up, and I'm buying this in faith, and you never get to it, and so it just kind of hangs there, and it's taunting you, right? I don't want this information to taunt you. Like I want you to find a way to just slip your hand in one side, just try to warm this thing up, because as you use this information, I really believe it's going to help you understand and honor and love Jesus, and then help other people in their process of reading the Bible for all it's worth. Okay? Lord, we love you. We thank you for today. We thank you for your word. Thank you for these students. Strengthen them as they study this amazing book. Thank you that it's alive. It's active. God, that you're filling your word with life. And as we read it, we read life. Help us to honor it. Thank you that you are with us in the journey. Amen.